session number 231 of the Salt Lake City 2008 Symposium entitled Why I Stay. This is the sixth time we've done this, where we've invited five prominent Mormons who have been involved in the church in various ways in various parts of the country to come and tell their story about why they have remained involved and faithful in the church despite individual circumstances, sittings, and so on. And I'm always astounded that we fill the place up here with people who want to hear those stories. It's great. I love hearing them myself. My name is Toby Pingree, and I'm... Can't hear? Is that better? Okay. Yell into it when you get up here. My name's Toby Pingree, and I'm the chair of this, and I will be the one who will make sure we get through on time, too. We've had problems with that in the past. Our five presenters are as follows. First will be Greg Prince, who is most recently well-known for his biography of David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism, that won numerous book awards, well-deserved, and was a great book. He's president and CEO of a medical research company back in Maryland. He started out life as a dentist and then became a pathologist also, and also dabbled in Mormon history for a long time. Second will be Levina Fielding Anderson, and her claim to fame, I guess, and this is why she stays, and you could add in her case about since they tried to kick her out, she still won't go. She stays, and Levina has her fingerprints all over all the Mormon publications. She's been editor and copy reviewer and things like that for all of them that I know of. She has a PhD in English from the University of Washington, and she runs her own editing firm now. Third will be Morris Thurston. Comes to us from Southern California. Morris is an attorney, a graduate of BYU and the Harvard Law Review. He's at law school. He was a partner in a large law firm in Southern California for a long time. Right now he's involved in, producing some of the legal stuff about Joseph Smith and his trials with Joe Bentley. Is that right? You may tell us about that. Anyway, he's involved in the... getting funding and establishing the chair for the Howard W. Hunter chair down at Claremont. Fourth will be Claudia Bushman, who she's now in Pasadena with her husband Richard. She's teaching, and she's been in many parts of the country, Maryland, New York, Boston, teaching, raising a family. She was one of the original founders of the Women's Exponent 2 back in Boston, she said, a long time ago, but it was, I think, one of the great, great contributions she made. And then finally, we have Jeff Burton, who is well known to those of you who are Sunstone readers. He has that Borderlands column that graces each issue of Sunstone, and I suspect... describes in part to many of us that are here today about how we deal with with issues in the church where we're expectations of what we're supposed to be don't quite fit what we are and how we deal with that. So anyway, so we'll go in that order, and if we have time at the end, we'll invite comments. We usually don't, but if we do, we'll go ahead. Greg.
Five generations of Mormons, going back to George Prince's conversion in South Africa in 1855, brought me into this church, but that is not the reason I stay, nor should it be. A religion that does not work for its members here and now, regardless of how well it worked for their ancestors, has little hold on those members. The church worked for my ancestors, and it works for me, and that is why I stay. I have spent my entire career spanning 35 years as a biological scientist. When I interviewed Paul Boyer several years ago, he pointed out to me that of all the natural sciences, biology was the least conducive to religious activity. To reinforce his point, He cited a major survey at the beginning of the 20th century and another at the end of the 20th century, both of which came to the same conclusion. Thus, he said, I was at high risk of becoming an atheist as he was. In fact, he said, he thought of proselytizing me because he thought I had promise. As a molecular biologist and the only Mormon ever to win a Nobel Prize, yes, there has been one, though you didn't read about it in the church news, Dr. Boyer had abandoned his faith decades earlier, and thus knew from firsthand experience about the threat that biology posed to faith. Somehow I avoided the same fate, never experiencing a crisis of faith, despite my total immersion in experimental biology, perhaps the riskiest domain within the already high-risk field of biology. Indeed, rather than taking me away from faith, biology gave me the tools to examine it and the church behind it, and ultimately to embrace and own them in a way I never could have imagined. The tools of scientific methodology, which transformed the Western world, have utility beyond the boundaries of science. Indeed, they have been appropriated, usually without attribution, by virtually every academic discipline. Witness the title of one academic periodical, the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion. In employing the tools of science to examine my own faith, I found that they were useful for some questions, but not for others, and that it was not difficult for me to distinguish between the two categories. For instance, the declaration, God lives, falls outside the scope of scientific inquiry, but the nature of revelation is fair game. Similarly, the declaration, Joseph Smith was God's prophet, is an expression of faith, outside the reach of science. But the manner in which he functioned as a prophet is accessible through scientific inquiry. As a result, I can summarize my encounter with Mormonism in four words. Go with the data. If a question is susceptible to scientific examination, make sure the data are solid, and then go with the data. If not, make the question a matter of faith and be content with it. This approach has never failed me. At no time have I walled off inconvenient truth and placed a do not enter sign on the wall. And I can say with confidence that I will never do so. I sorrow for those whose fear of truth causes them to act otherwise. I cannot see how it is possible for them to own their religion while they disown truths about it. For the past two decades, I have immersed myself in data relating to my religion. First, an eight-year study of LDS priesthood that involved reading hundreds of thousands of pages of manuscripts and publications, some of which predated the founding of the church in 1830. Next, a 10-year study of David O. McKay that began with his 40,000-page diary and extended to hundreds of thousands of pages of other materials, along with 200 interviews that included several general authorities and two church presidents. And finally, an ongoing study of Leonard Arrington, former church historian and one of the giants of Mormon historiography. Nobody can claim to have seen it all, but I have seen plenty. Enough so that I doubt there are any significant surprises out there. And I am still here, more firmly planted than before. On the basis of the data I have examined and a lifetime of church experience, let me share with you a few of the foundations of my own faith. Since I am now in my seventh decade of life, as of 3 months ago, there is the possibility that some of them may brush up against claims of wisdom. You will be the judges. Number one, I see God within Mormonism. That is a statement of faith and not of data. I see his hand and work frequently, sometimes on a macro scale, but more often in the lives of ordinary Latter-day Saints who spend their lives in near anonymity trying to make their religion work. There was a time long ago, and some of you will understand that certitude peaks at 19 years of age, when I confidently said that God was only within Mormonism, but I subsequently witnessed too much of him in other institutions, churches, and otherwise, to allow me to continue making such an exclusive statement. I also realized that I lacked the authority, to say nothing of the chutzpah, to tell God how to spend his time. It is enough for me to see his presence within Mormonism. What he chooses to do with the rest of his time and his omnipresence are his own business. Number two, doubt is not only permissible, but also essential to healthy faith. When life progresses in an orderly fashion, when the righteous prosper and the wicked suffer, faith is easy and indeed not even necessary. But when aberrations occur, even though you thought you had filled in all the boxes, the test comes. Doubts arise naturally, and we should not be ashamed of them. Instead, look at them as doorways that lead to increased faith. In 1955, when I was 7 years old, the world of amusement changed forever with the opening of Disneyland. I grew up in Los Angeles, and within months, our family took the one-hour drive to the exciting new theme park. One of the attractions taken from the classic cartoon, The Wind in the Willows, was Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. We sat in a car and were taken on a twisting, turning ride through the English countryside of a century earlier. Along the way, we saw road signs, among which were Derbyshire, Devonshire, and one I had never heard of but have visited frequently in recent years, Not So Sure. Healthy doubt leads to healthy faith. Only when you have placed your religion under the microscope and examined the possibility that it might not be true, to use my frame of reference, since I have spent my entire career looking through a microscope, or when you have conducted the experiment by planting the seed, to use Alma's frame of reference, can you claim to own, rather than borrow, your own faith? Living on borrowed light is a lousy lifestyle. Number three, no theology could be loftier than one that says that humankind has infinite potential. In Mormonism's theology, the reward for a life well lived is not eternal bliss, but eternal progression. It is the American dream writ large. It is also a call to action in the here and now, for we will take with us the tools that we have acquired and sharpened during this life and continue to use and improve them in the next. Number four, on a good day, Joseph Smith was very, very good. Similarly, today's church leaders at all levels have very, very good days. They also have bad days, as did Joseph Smith and his successors. I make that statement out of empathy, not criticism, for in my own career of scientific discovery, I have had a few good days and many, many bad ones. Why would religion be any different? One of my interviewees told me of a conversation he had with Harold B. Lee, the 11th president of the church. President Lee asked about this man's brother, who at one time had sat on a high committee at church headquarters, but subsequently had left the church. When the man replied that his brother had left because he saw the workings of power from too close a vantage point, President Lee replied, I can think of much better reasons to leave the church. Doesn't he realize that we are just human beings trying to do our best? When I see church leaders doing their best, it is a beautiful thing to behold. At other times, I rejoice that we share so much in common. Number five, we are all flawed physicians trying to heal each other. Even as a physician without patients is not complete, so we as flawed saints cannot be complete outside a community of other flawed saints. For that reason, Mormonism, and indeed any branch of Christianity, is empty if it is practiced in isolation. It is as arrogant for a saint to shun a congregation because it lacks peers as it is for a physician to refuse treatment of patients who are not peers. The inner religious life is essential, but without an outer religious life in the community of believers, it is the sound of one hand clapping. Number six, trickle-up revelation is not only alive and well within the church, but is arguably the most important form of revelation shaping the day-to-day church in which we live. If you doubt that statement, consider that the Relief Society, Mutual, Sunday School, Primary, Welfare Program, Genealogy Program, and Young Adult Program, to name an incomplete list, all began as grassroots initiatives on the part of creative church members that subsequently were embraced and institutionalized by the Central Church. That means that phrases such as magnifying one's calling, men should be anxiously engaged in a good cause and do many things of their own free will and bring to pass much righteousness, and be not weary in well-doing, for ye are laying the foundation of a great work, and out of small things proceedeth that which is great. These are not mere platitudes, but calls to action. Having been a first-hand witness of and participant in the birth of the young adult program, in Southern California in the early 1970s. And having been a first-hand witness of the effect of Lester Bush's landmark monograph on blacks and priesthood in the mid-1970s, I know whereof I speak. A church that not only allows but also expects its members to assist in its continual transformation by magnifying their callings, placing their gifts on the altar, call it what you may, is one that has my vote. Number 7, the missionary program is the glue that holds the church together. My experiences as a missionary in Brazil over 40 years ago shaped my life and continue to inform it. If the collective efforts of 60,000 missionaries did not result in single baptism, we would still be the better off for their having served. My oldest son is now serving in the California San Bernardino Mission, and his weekly letters bear ample witness to the transformational power of the mission, as well as take me back to my own experiences long ago and far away. Number 8, what Jews did to guilt, Mormons have done to the family. Jews didn't invent guilt, but they raised it to an art form. Similarly, Mormons did not invent the family, although you might think otherwise if you listen to some of your co-religionists. But we have taken it to a different level. The doctrine of eternal families is beautiful and pure. Even if details such as where one will spend Thanksgiving in the next dinner in the next life and how many turkeys will have to be ordered remain unanswered. Yet Mormonism's contribution is not limited to the then and there. One only need look at the patronage of our family history centers, which is overwhelmingly non-Mormon, to understand. No other institution in the world has done as much to turn the hearts of parents and children, living and dead, to each other. Perhaps this is the most important gift of Mormonism to the world. Number 9, speaking of family, the church is the village that helped raise and will continue to help raise my kids, who are now in their 20s. It's a hazardous world out there, particularly for kids, and they need all the help they can get to navigate the hazards. I am well aware of the church's deficiencies when it comes to the youth, perhaps the most irritating of which is that the kids consider it, in their word, boring. There is much that can be done to improve the youth programs, and perhaps my call to action will motivate some of you to put on your creative thinking caps. Even with those deficiencies, however, it is a strong beacon light in the midst of a storm. One of the most gratifying things in my life has been to hear my kids, without provocation, express their appreciation for the teachings and standards that they once fought, but now realize are the foundation upon which they can build an entire life. Seeing the lives of so many of their peers come apart at an early age helps to reinforce the lesson. Number 10, and finally, at a time in this country when aversion to Mormonism is at historically high levels, its high negative profile also presents us with an unprecedented opportunity to sit down at the table with other faith traditions and lower the levels of distrust. To do so, however, we have to do 2 things. 1, acknowledge that there is a table, and 2, learn to speak the language of those who already sit there. If you do that, you will see that we have much to offer, yet far more to learn. This is what President Monson was getting at in his first press conference when he said, "I think we should not be sequestered in a little cage. I think we have a responsibility to be active in the communities where we live, all Latter-day Saints, and to work cooperatively with other churches and other organizations. My objective there is that I think it is important that we eliminate the weakness of one standing alone and substitute for it the strength of people working together. There are many efforts where, as we get together as various religions in the community and work toward the common goal, it should be successful. We have cooperated with Red Cross, the Catholic churches, and other churches to make this a better community and a better world. I believe in that spirit." End quote. There are authentic bad guys out there, and it will take a concerted effort on the part of all of the good guys if we are to prevail. The last thing we need is to fight a civil war with our Christian siblings, our Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist cousins, and even our agnostic and atheistic in-laws who are of goodwill. By joining with them in good causes, we strengthen our own identity. We do not diminish it. My own experiences with the Wesley Theological Seminary community in Washington, D.C. over the past several years are solid proof to me of this statement. So, that is why I stay. That and the fact that, to borrow from Ronald Reagan's first presidential campaign, I paid for that microphone, and so I intend to keep using it.
Well, Toby, in a fit of tact, neglected to mention that I've been excommunicated, and so if there was anyone in the audience who wanted to know the circumstances under which I'm staying, I felt I should clarify that point. I'm deeply honored to be one of this panel, sharing with you my observations on why I remain attached to the church. I received an email from my niece, Shalom, who was just a child when I was excommunicated, finally asking some questions about what had happened and wondering why I stayed attached to the church, by which I mean that I show up on Sunday for the 3-hour marathon. And then within 48 hours of receiving her email, I received the invitation from Toby to be on this panel. So I could tell I was getting a message. It was time to think about it and talk about it. Last week, as I started pulling material together for this presentation, I looked at the very spot I was standing 15 years ago in a meadow near our cabin, up to my waist in dozens of shades of green, and three pieces of knowledge came to me with unmistakable clarity and authority. First, I would be excommunicated. This was over the Mormon Alliance issues, for those of you who don't know. Second, I was not to go to the court. And third, it would be a long time before I was reinstated, and all three of those pieces are, in fact, factual. Because my opportunities for bearing testimony are quite limited, usually to journalists, I'd like to use this occasion to do so despite my somewhat ambivalent status of being of, but not in, the church. I've used the comparison before about how people tend to see Mormons as either in or out, like flipping a coin. Tails, which is what you're sitting on in meetings, you're in. Heads, for us so-called intellectuals, in Elder Packer's elegant terms, we're out. I see myself as occupying the ambiguous position of a coin balanced on its edge. I also want to make it crystal clear that I am speaking only for myself, and I want absolutely nothing I say to be interpreted as criticism of anyone else's choices, whether that choice is to stop reading and thinking about a troubling Mormon question to allow continued participation with greater peace of mind, whether the choice is to drift quietly into inactivity, whether the choice is to seek spiritual experiences in a different tradition or faith community, whether it's to say that's the last straw and walk out slamming the door, whether it's to look at people like me and say, what's your problem? Or whether it's looking a leader squarely in the eye and saying, this is what I believe, this is what I don't believe, do what you think you have to do. I respect, admire, and accept those choices. I'm not advocating my solution or my situation for anyone, but I'm also not accepting anyone else's criticism or judgment of my situation. It's right for me. So why do I stay? There are six reasons, and I'm presenting them in no particular order. The first is for my family. The gospel was everything to my parents, the source of meaning for them, order, hope, and help. They both served missions in the 1930s when my dad was an orphan who walked holes through the soles of both shoes because he couldn't afford to have them repaired. And then, as an ordinary farmer who always struggled financially, went on to be bishop in two wards that built chapels at a time when wards not only had to pay the lion's share of the funding, but also contribute much of the labor. All six of us children served missions. There was never a time from our teen years on that we didn't have callings. All of us married in the temple. My mother's family goes back to Tennessee and joined the church in Nauvoo. Although, as nearly as I can tell, the ancestor that we consider to be a martyr in Nauvoo was hanged not because he was a Mormon, but because he was a horse thief. My dad's family joined the church in England and immigrated to Utah in 1857. I wanted our son Christian to have that heritage, and I wanted it to mean something to him. It couldn't if I communicated that it meant nothing to me. Christian served an honorable mission in a very difficult location and married in the temple. Because of our family's Mormonness, these experiences were shared experiences that brought us closer together. He was 14 at the time of the excommunication. Not divisive experiences. It's true that I sat out in the overcrowded, overheated lobby of the San Diego temple while Christian was being married inside, but Lori Winter Stromberg sat out with me, and I'll always cherish that act of friendship. The second reason is that Paul and I met, courted, married, and lived as Mormons. I didn't want the church to come between us in our marriage. Our temple ceiling and those covenants were significant to us. We both valued a Mormon lifestyle. During the 2 years I was growing more concerned about the problem of ecclesiastical abuse in the church, Paul was playing devil's advocate. He is the fairest person I know. He will bend over backwards to see another person's point of view, whether they deserve it or not. And never once did he try to tell me not to do something. He always wanted to discuss all the information available, talk about it, and see it from every angle, then work on the consequences together. He asked all the hard questions and all the good ones, and none of the unfair ones. I absolutely cannot say enough good about him. When the letter was delivered scheduling the court, he changed on a dime. He was 100% supportive. The questions were over. There were no more questions, and not even once, and I told you so. We still think the same Mormon things are funny or outrageous, and quite frequently, after something particularly dumb has happened, the Mitt Romney campaign supplied a fairly steady supply for a while, Paul would shake his head sadly and say, "What a strange church you used to belong to, Levina." The third reason is that I love Mormonism. I had a testimony of the Book of Mormon before I had one of Joseph Smith, and it's continued to speak to me as scripture. When President Benson began urging people to read the Book of Mormon every year, I thought that was probably a pretty good idea. And I've done it, either on paper or listening to tapes ever since. I love Joseph Smith. I don't always like Joseph Smith, and I'm pretty sure he got some important things wrong, but I love his spiritual and intellectual aliveness, his willingness to listen and think about things in a new way. Fourth, I love Mormon theology. I love its emphasis on grace and on works. I love its open canon of scripture. I love the presence of Mother in Heaven, even with a gag in her mouth. I love the doctrine of free agency and the doctrine of eternal progression, even though the first has been dumbed down to moral agency by Elder Packer, and the second has been dabbed down during President Hinckley's administration to a little couplet we don't know too much about. I hope most of you either heard Hugo Olaez's presentation this morning or are going to buy the CD. I love the Mormon community. This is fifth. Paul and I have lived in the same ward for 31 years now, so we're some of the older people in that ward. Pieces of it are natural and familiar, like which bench we sit on, the fact that the air conditioning that keeps the chapel comfortable has frost forming on the windows of the Relief Society room, that we can count on the primary kids singing for special programs with enthusiasm, if not tunefulness, and that the bishop will wear a funny tie at least a couple of times a month. Parts of it aren't always comfortable. For more than a year now, the bishopric has asked speakers to base their talks on a conference top in the ensign, and the High Council usually does too. Usually Paul sits on the aisle side, so he takes the sacrament and motions for it to go on, so I don't have to deal with that. Although a few weeks ago I was sitting on the aisle side, an elderly high priest made a big deal of stretching way past me to hand the bread to Paul. Maybe he was being tactful, or maybe he thought I'd contaminate it if I touched it, but when he came around with the water, I grabbed it from him, glared, and passed it to Paul, and then back to him, and then I got the giggles. Okay, that's only weirdly funny. But weirdly funny is the essence of community living. The hellion who terrorized the neighborhood as a teenager went on a mission, came back, shoveled widows' sidewalks after a storm wearing only tennis shoes, and is now a bishop in a ward in the south end of the valley. Or try this. I was waiting to see what President Monson's first official letter would be, and it was a double whammy of trivia. First, no visual aids in sacrament meeting. And second, speakers should not ask the congregation to look up scriptures and follow along. I couldn't help remembering a really unforgettable talk in which the speaker in our ward, this was just about 5 months ago, demonstrated several methods of eating Oreos, including dipping them in milk, which he poured into a glass at the pulpit. I can't remember what the point of his talk was. And when the member of the bishopric read the first President Monson's first letter, he is not the imaginative sort, but he was sufficiently puzzled by these instructions that he felt he had to come up with an explanation. It was, "I guess that will cut down on the ruckus during sacrament meeting." Then a couple of weeks later, when the young women were reporting their camp experience, one of the girls pulled out her quad and said, "My favorite scripture is Proverbs 7, and then interrupted herself to exclaim, "Don't look it up!" Paul and I both got the giggles. Emily Dickinson said she saw the world New Englandly. I see the world Mormonly. It's an important part of my identity, maybe the most important part. My people, my music, my mode of prayer, my history, my family. I took the steps that put my membership in jeopardy because I genuinely felt called to do so. I had hope of calling the church back to its better self, even though I definitely feel that correcting the church is Jesus' job, not anybody else's. I wouldn't have become inactive or left the church on my own, so just because the church tore up my membership, why is that a reason to leave? I want to be here when the time comes for our paths to rejoin. It hasn't always been easy, although it hasn't been as hard as I thought it might be. My own sloth and boredom, not another High Council talk on following the prophet, are much greater obstacles than theological differences, being offended by insensitive members, or feeling that it's just not worth it. The church had power over my membership, but it didn't have power over my Mormonness, and I've continued to claim that. I had a lot of spiritual preparation in dealing with the issues and the possible consequences before I was excommunicated. Even though part of me didn't really believe that the church would excommunicate somebody for telling the truth, even though it was a pretty unpopular and unpretty truth, I knew that loyalty, conformity, and obedience were huge values, and that I was trespassing them by speaking out. I felt, and still do, that I was acting out of love, loyalty, and commitment. My patriarchal blessing cautions me more than once to be humble. I think it was inspired. So I really paid attention in the months between the publication of my dialogue article and the conversations with my stake president and the final excommunication about whether I was being proud or hostile or indifferent in the stand I felt compelled to take. I truly and sincerely felt that I wasn't. So I didn't feel that the official rejection had much power over me, over the essence of who I was. I've talked about what I love about Mormonism, but I need to say that the sixth and most crucial reason for staying is that I feel loved. I feel loved by my Heavenly Father and my Heavenly Mother, and deeply, truly loved by Jesus. I can't help loving them back. I want to love them more deeply, in part by keeping the promises I made at baptism and in the temple, and daily in my prayers. These promises are important to me. Do I think someone else can make promises in an other than Mormon context and keep them with the same fidelity and be cherished in the same way by God? Absolutely, I do. But this is the mold, the Mormon mold, in which I choose to keep those promises. I don't think a few words in the temple made my sealing to Paul or our sealing to Christian real, but I think our shared commitment to live as though it's real does make it real. I think God honors many kinds of promises made in many places, but that's one of them, and that one is mine. And lest I come across as too ghastly noble, I have to admit that I have my share of stubbornness. If I left, they, whoever they are, would win by being there every Sunday and claiming a place. I'm saying, deal with it. I'm saying, I'm not going anywhere. Get over it. Last week, when I was looking at the meadow with all of its varieties of green and thinking about what had happened 15 years ago, I realized that I would have changed nothing in the intervening time. We live so much of our lives in compromise and half measures and almost and not quite that it's a privilege and an honor to take a clear stand on an issue of conscience. As I reviewed the last 15 years, I know I have lived them with plenty of moments of pride and sloth and selfishness, but I hope that I have also lived them with dignity and integrity and a good sense of humor. What I felt in the meadow last week was that I have lived those years with love. The love of my family, the love of good friends, and above all, the love of the Savior who said, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, ye have done it unto me." Thank you.
Levine is a difficult act to follow. I have learned one thing. I have the biggest print of anyone on the page, and I'm going to have to still hold this closer than anyone else. In order to stay somewhere, as Greg Prince has noted, one has to be there in the first place. I started out Mormon because I am the descendant of Mormon pioneers and was born to good and loving Mormon parents. When I was 19, I decided to go on a mission. Being called to Norway seemed like the perfect answer to a prayer. I would be returning to the birthplace of my ancestor, Tora Thurston. My first Norwegian winter was like a dunk in icy water. I served in Trondheim, not far south of the Arctic Circle. The nights were long. The sun peaked over the horizon about 10 a.m., rolled along the tops of the southern hills, and had disappeared by 2:30 p.m. Like most missionaries in those days, I arrived in the field with hardly a word of Norwegian. We were expected to absorb the language from senior companions who themselves spoke it poorly. Rejection was our common denominator. The first Christmas, we asked our families at home to send toys for children at a state-run orphanage. We delivered them the day before Christmas, and the children were thrilled. The next morning, the toys were back on the steps of our church. The adults who ran the orphanage would not accept charity from Mormons. I'm not easily intimidated or discouraged. Although several of my friends and companions were sent home early, I somehow survived. Even bad experiences became opportunities for growth. Like the time I was sent to the police station to negotiate the release of an elder who had been jailed for public indecency. I had to negotiate with the authorities using words that missionaries seldom had reason to use, and succeeded in freeing the elder only by promising that he would be on the first airplane home. For the most part, I didn't challenge the accepted wisdom in those days, at least not overtly. Some of my attitudes embarrass me today. One Sunday morning, quoting Joseph Fielding Smith, I chastised a local member with five children who suggested that it might be acceptable to use birth control for family planning. Another time, I listened to two visiting missionaries from Scotland, a country where the baptismal rate had reached legendary proportions, talk about how you could use a six-in-one lesson plan to baptize tons of children. While inwardly skeptical, I held my tongue. I shouldn't have. I felt much inspiration in the scriptures. I loved Ether 12:27, where the Lord explained that he gives us weaknesses that we might be humble, and that if we humble ourselves and have faith in him, he will turn our weaknesses into strengths. I decided I wouldn't worry about the fact that convert baptisms in Norway were as rare as a heat wave in Hammerfest. I would do my best, be open to inspiration, and let the Lord take care of the rest. My mission experience is a reason I stay in the church. The Ether promise seemed to work well during the next several years. Even though they were hectic, I still felt I could do anything with the Lord's help. My grades shot upward. I married the most beautiful girl I'd ever met, who turned out to have a sparkling mind and a good heart, and with whom I'm still in love 42 years later. Success in law school and career followed, but as I matured, I began to look at my religion with an inquisitive eye. I saw a few things that didn't seem right. The practice of denying the priesthood to African Americans was especially troublesome to me. Shortly after I returned from my mission, I heard a devotional talk given by Ezra Taft Benson, castigating the civil rights movement and calling its leaders communists or fellow travelers. I wrote a letter to the editor of the Daily Universe, suggesting that if Elder Benson was going to speak on political issues, he should do so in a forum meeting, not a devotional. Then I worried for days, thinking I would become a pariah at BYU when it was published. But of course, it never was. Several years later, after reading Lester Bush's dialogue article, I felt even more strongly that the restrictions were wrong. Why couldn't the church leaders see that? Although I never doubted their good intentions, I came to accept that our readers might be human beings, subject to human fallibilities. Of course, I hadn't been called to lead the church, but God had given me the right to seek personal revelation, and I saw that it was my responsibility to exercise that right. The church presented many frustrations for me as the years flew by. Unfortunately, and much to my wife's dismay, I'm a cynic by nature, a trait that is often difficult to fit into the umbrella of Mormonism. For example, I can't abide the fact that we repeat the same lessons year after year in Sunday school, and the teachers almost never ask thought-provoking questions. And yet, when I look at the long view, I see that many of the most sacred experiences in my life happened as a result of my membership and activity in the church. And I have time for only a couple of examples. Our fifth child was named Elise. We'd already lost one baby, Laura, whose premature death gave her only 10 days of life. Elise was a full term, a happy baby with sparkling eyes. One day when she was almost 4 months old, she died of sudden infant death syndrome, a crib death. It was the worst day of my life. We had just moved to Orange County a few months earlier, but we decided to bury Elise next to Laura near our old home. We didn't expect anyone from our current stake to make the 2-hour round trip to the cemetery for a small graveside service. But when the time came, there was our stake president, our bishop, their wives, and other brothers and sisters, all with busy lives, as well from Orange County, as well as friends from our former ward in Glendale, there to let us know that they shared our grief. We've been fortunate in not needing the help of the church often, but it is comforting and faith-promoting to know that the members are there to offer true Christian service when needed. I have a great deal of respect for our present-day leaders, the ones I know personally, though few, being from California, are honest and sincere. Unlike some so-called Christian ministers, they're not in it for the money. Most of them could earn far more working in occupations for which they are trained. It is remarkable how seldom our highest leaders are tainted by scandal. I may not always share their views, but I realize they have put in far more hours of service to the Lord than I have, and they deserve to be listened by me with respect. When I was a teenager, I received my patriarchal blessing. I was told that I had a special calling in the area of family history. During our first year of marriage, while we were still attending BYU, Don and I were infused with a passion for discovering and telling stories of our ancestors. Years later, while practicing law full-time, I began researching the life of my Norwegian immigrant ancestor. For 10 years, I devoted nights, weekends, and holidays to this project, and I was never happier than when I was immersed in it. Eventually, I published a biography of this man and his family, whose fascinating stories deserve to be told. The book met with some critical acclaim, and soon I was lecturing to groups on how to write a life story. About the same time, Don became involved in teaching and pioneering a course on memoir writing at the Santiago Canyon College. Over the years, we've lectured jointly at many venues, including this year's Sunstone, and our book on life story writing was just published last year. Pursuing and encouraging others to pursue personal and family history has been one of the most rewarding endeavors of our lives. What other church so fully incorporates these things into its teachings? So that is another reason that I stay. I am both fascinated and inspired by church history. One of the most emotionally charged moments of my life took place in the Kirtland Temple a few years ago. We were there for a Sunday devotional meeting with the other members of the Mormon History Association. Some of you may have been there. Don and I were members of the choir that filled the lofts in the four corners of the temple. We were to sing the same hymns that my ancestor, Edson Barney, sang when he attended the dedication of the Kirtland Temple in 1836. My heart has always been especially touched by music. As we raised our voices in song, I was unable to sing anything. As a powerful image of how those early members of the church must have experienced that grand day of spiritual outpouring came to me. The Spirit of God, like a fire, is burning. The latter-day glory begins to come forth. The visions and blessings of old are returning. The angels are coming to visit the earth. We'll sing and we'll shout with the armies of heaven, "Hosanna, Hosanna to God and the Lamb. Let glory to them in the highest be given, henceforth and forever. Amen and amen." My eyes filled with tears as I thought about the challenges that Edson and his family were to face, but could not then have predicted. Losing their savings in the Kirtland Safety Society, losing their profit to mob violence, and being asked to leave their homes to go to the Rocky Mountains. I thought of how my ancestors refused to be intimidated or to let discouragement drive them out of the church. And I knew that this was yet another reason I stay. Like any worthwhile thing, church membership has its challenges. I recognize that I have not been called to lead the church and would never presume to preach my somewhat, sometimes unorthodox ideas as doctrine. Still, there are many things about the church that I cannot make sense of. I think we would benefit if women were given an opportunity to serve in all of our presiding bodies. I think we would benefit if the church supported our gay brothers and sisters who decide to enter into a committed relationship, whether or not it is called a marriage, rather than discourage them. The last couple of months have been especially difficult for me. I have studied and prayed concerning the First Presidency's letter asking the California Saints to support a constitutional amendment barring same-sex marriages, but I have not been able to feel good about it. I wrote a letter to my bishop explaining my concerns. I strove to make it well-reasoned, even-handed, and non-confrontational. I was attempting to raise serious issues in an appropriate way. I didn't question the motives of our leaders. I didn't send a copy of my letter to the press. I didn't solicit converts to my way of thinking from the ward. Last Sunday at a special Joint Priesthood Relief Society meeting, I listened while our bishop compared those who refused to support the amendment to the wicked and foolish people of Noah's time. I listened to a member of the stake president explain that we were engaged in a conflict not unlike the premortal war in heaven. I learned that expressing compassion for our gay brothers and sisters was part of Lucifer's plan. I learned that following the counsel of the church, I learned that considering issues of fairness was part of Lucifer's plan. I learned that following the counsel of the church leaders trumps everything else. As I listened to me, it occurred that these talks could have been given, and this is a parenthetical remark, in 1857 by church leaders in the southern Utah as they encouraged the killing of innocent men, women, and children. But that perhaps is a subject for another talk. It was terribly distressing for me to sit through this meeting, perhaps the more so because I counted both of these men as good friends. They are good people. I couldn't conceive of condemning them even privately as narrow-minded bigots. Why couldn't they accept that I had honestly studied and prayed and reached a conclusion that was at odds with theirs? That even though our opinions differed, none of us were followers of Satan. Did I mention that I'm not easily intimidated or discouraged? This battle will not cause me to leave the church. I'm encouraged when we're told that the gospel encompasses all truths. I take comfort in what an apostle has said during my lifetime, that we're not so much concerned with whether your thoughts are orthodox or heterodox as we are that you shall have thoughts. I have faith that there will be other apostles who will express similar sentiments in the future. I read the past and see that change is possible. We are now told that our church has nothing to do with polygamy, notwithstanding that it was a crucial doctrine to our pioneer ancestors. We now grant the priesthood to all worthy male members and do not preach against interracial marriages. I hope for a future where more diversity of people and opinions is tolerated. Like the Reverend King, I have a dream. It is of a general conference. I see 12 apostles sitting on the stand. My eyes slowly scan them from left to right. I know it is sometime in the future because some of them are wearing striped shirts. And some have facial hair. Some are persons of color. Before my eyes reach the right end of the group, I wake up. I'm not sure if there are any women on that end, and I can't tell if any of the group is gay. If the past is a guide, change often comes as a result of people, both inside and outside the church, raising issues that are prayerfully considered by the prophet and the apostles, who are entitled to revelation. And so I stay, hoping that my voice and others will raise issues that will bring about beneficial changes, all the while recognizing my own limitations. Because I understand that, like all fallible and imperfect humans, I too could be wrong. Thank you.
I don't want to explore why I stay in the church. I just don't like that question. Of course, I've had some pretty horrific experiences that could have persuaded many to leave. I could give a very salty talk about put downs I have experienced and insults that I have borne. I have been publicly and privately insulted and humiliated on several occasions. And if I went into any details at all, I'm sure you would agree that I've been treated very badly, and that I have every right to shake the dust of Zion from my shoes. And I'm certainly not alone among those who have suffered at the hands of our leaders. I have observed lots of such experiences in the church, and watched with sorrow as some people I know and love have finally announced their unwillingness to bear that final straw and left. I don't think they are any happier or better off without the church. My question is not why I stay in the church, but why should I leave? I love the church. I don't want to leave it. My church experience and identity is deeply ingrained. It may come before my identity as a woman. It certainly comes before my identity as an American. My grandparents came from four different countries and, caught up in the gospel net, left their homes and families and came to a new place, forging new families and connections. None of them ever left the church. None of them ever returned to their previous homes. They remained faithful to the end, as did my parents. The church was the mixing bowl that brought them together and the mold that shaped their lives. During bad times, and they suffered some very bad ones, it was all in all to them. They were great people within their own spheres, devoted to the gospel, and to them I owe a heavy debt that I currently pay on whenever I can. I don't ever want to compromise their steadiness and sacrifice. They pointed the direction to a way of life, a purpose, and an identity. Thank heaven for that. Besides, I personally owe a very great debt to the church. Look what the church provides. A community wherever you go. An arena for participation to do whatever you want. And a cadre of the best and most willing workers in the world. The church gives you a sense of where you are. It gives you a purchase on life. You see things in context. One of my first memories is standing before a large group at Christmas time singing, "Oh, Hush Be My Baby, A Story I'll Tell." I had my little rubber doll wrapped in a dish towel, and I rocked her as I sang, completely caught up in the feeling of Christmas, unafraid, singing to my brothers and sisters as I had been taught to do. Mormons are the most tolerant of audiences. We are all part of the group, and as we dispense good feelings and kindness, we can expect acceptance and approval in return. I spent my youth in that protected globe, where good feelings were so generously dispensed. When I attended my 50th high school reunion a few years back, one of my old friends surprised me by saying that I was the only person in the class who seemed to have any idea of what I was doing, that I knew something succeeded high school. What a blessing not to be dependent on the values and approvals of my beautiful, much-loved, but absolutely crazy high school class. They did not have a clue. Thanks to the church I lived in, the alternative universe of San Francisco Sunset Ward, as well as in the dispensation of the fullness of times, I had a little purchase on life. The church provided me with a perfect school. Everything I ever needed to know, I learned in church. I learned to give talks, be in programs and plays, respond politely and warmly when I was spoken to, sing parts, learn the tango many times. I learned how to sing thousands of songs, conduct a meeting, organize an outing. Because I gave lots of talks, I was able to organize and carry forward many school and civic projects, do a great deal of community service. Because I've been in hundreds of musical presentations, I can lead a choir and put on a pretty good presentation of my own. Because I was president of little primary groups, I learned how to manage big programs and have carried on many since. The church provides myriads of communities, plural. Once in graduate school, I was talking to a friend. She said she was sad, that she felt lonely and alone in the universe. I told her that I sometimes felt that way, but she said, I could not possibly understand because I had the Mormons. Of course, she was right. I never will really feel that way because I always do have the Mormons. I can find friends anywhere. I already have friends everywhere. I have a community to belong to any place I go. I can visit the elders on the street. I can find people who are recognizably Mormon, who know people I know, even if I don't know them to begin with. I can start a conversation and have instant intimacy in no time. We've lived in three cities and three wards during the last year. We have dear friends in all of them. What I most value about the church is the way we create our congregations and carry on our church business. We have leaders and manuals and traditions, but we're still on our own, creating our own classes and relationships. Each congregation with its own character, its own strengths and weaknesses. Each of us has a place in it, if we wish to occupy them. We have a built-in group of friends if we choose to take them up. We don't have to interact with all those people all the time, but we can if we want to. What else do I like? I love the way the church is an arena for all the kinds of projects I want to do. I'm a project person. I get it from my mother and my grandmother, who are always putting on projects. My mother would get an idea and then cajole her brothers and sisters to help her bring it to fruition. And it wasn't too hard to get them to do that because she could be charm itself. And because she had taken them through so many delightful events, programs, and other things in the past. The Mormon people are a dream to work with. So cooperative, so willing, usually so dependable, so reliable. They've all been through the same boot camp, learning how to do things, learning how to say yes instead of no, learning how to support and serve others. They are just dreams of cooperation. I love to work with Mormons. They know how to do it. Nobody does it better. One of my daughters-in-law had a living nativity scene with the neighbors every Christmas when her children were young. It was the usual manger scene with costumes, coming of the shepherds, kings, scriptures read, songs sung. But she discovered very early that the neighboring kids could not sing. They had never learned how. She had to salt her groups with primary kids who could carry tunes and who knew the Christmas songs. There is just no substitute for the saints. Nobody works and cooperates the way they do. A few years back, when the Manhattan Temple was under construction, we began work on our youth jubilee. We had a group of 2,500 young people from 15 or so distant states. We had the largest cast, that had ever appeared on the stage of the Radio City Music Hall, a thrilling, if venerable, venue, where it is very difficult to get on and off the stage. We had one day in the theater, the performance day. The professional staff said there was absolutely no way in the world that we could put on a show like that with volunteer labor. But, of course, we did. And it was a great show, sharp, tight, entertaining, and as our frugal President Hinckley, who happened to attend, said, worth every penny. The experience was thrilling and rewarding to us, so much so that afterwards I think every one of us would have gone from Manhattan to Nauvoo on our knees if anyone had suggested it. In working together, we become families. I love the people I work with. We become rich in fellow feeling, even as we accomplish some pretty good things. And working together is the ultimate lesson we learn. Not to accomplish the task, but to work together. Not to sulk, not to rise to anger, not to walk out, but to work together. That's one of the reasons that I forgive the slights of insensitive leaders. They just haven't learned how to work together as they should. Our poor leaders are hard used. They are overworked. They are under terrible pressure. But they should have learned that unity lesson before they were promoted to their lofty perches. We are to love one another, treat each other with respect, and work peaceably together. We have such an interesting church structure, such colorful doctrines, such tortured relationships with other churches and individuals. All this has been cast in rather bright relief during recent events. It is so interesting to see what people think of us and to attempt to negotiate those relationships. I am so glad not to be anything ordinary in the religious line, but to have a history, beliefs, and activities that leave others incredulous, amazed, horrified, bewildered, even as they find our people square, ingenuous, remarkably successful, and too good to be true. I don't consider myself a very good person. I tend to be snide, cynical, and critical. I never managed to be the good, sweet girl I was taught to be at church. It's all part of my left-handed, depressed psyche. I could very well be a bitter person. I could be one of those who is poisoned by her own gall, sometimes is. I could be a very unhappy person, but I'm not. I'm sociable, friendly, and warm. I know that people rely on me, and I rely on them. I'm interested in what they're doing. Our church experience is full of these wonderful relationships. So I've given a number of reasons why I do not intend to leave the church, listed things that the church has done for me. But important as those are to me, as grateful as I am for my experiences, these are not the most important reasons I would give. Why don't I leave the church? Because the church needs me. The church needs people like me who are longtime church members, who've lived outside of Utah for many years, who can speak the language of the outsider and explain things that are otherwise inexplicable. The church needs her intellectuals, people who can talk to secular thinkers who dismiss Mormonism and not be ruffled, who are willing to take a little guff and ridicule for their beliefs. The church needs people who have learned the church's lessons and can teach them to the next generation, who can run things and carry projects along. The church needs older people who, once their children are grown, are willing to man the outposts of society, to go on missions, to take part in community activities, to demonstrate the wonderful service we so often direct inwardly. The church needs people, particularly women, who speak out in frank ways during lessons and discussions to give courage to those who have things to say but who dare not say them. The church needs people who, having had more experience, do not give pat answers. The church needs older women who do more than sit in their rocking chairs and quilt. I don't want to add to the statistics of the anger, the offended, the disillusioned. This is my church. This is my life. So why would I even think of leaving the church? I'm happy here. I hope and pray that the church does not decide to to leave me.
I was just telling Toby, I have a half hour now. He said, no, 15 minutes. Anyway, it's great to be here. Why we stay? You see the irony in that statement? Why do we stay? Can you think of any good reason? Nah, let's go to lunch. Oh, just kidding. Yeah. It's interesting that we should have to ask this question of ourselves. Why do we stay? And, you know, most other organizations are really concerned about, you know, why are they leaving, as has been mentioned? Why do they go? And I'm sure our group, our church, has looked very carefully at all the reasons that people go. We have a very sophisticated research arm of the church. I'm sure they know what some of the reasons are, what the reasons are. Yeah, because, you know, the best statistics we have are a little old, but say that about 80% of our baptized members lose their faith or they lose their confidence in the church sometime during their lifetime. Or for whatever reason, they don't stay, they go inactive. And, of course, there's a lot of different definitions for what it means to stay. We're talking about, you know, attendance, being partially active or less active, or are we talking about staying with a group or a ward? Are we talking about staying as a temple recommend holder? Are we talking about staying as a committed, involved, faithful member, and so forth? So each of us has a little different approach to this, and I'm not going to say which is different, because you are different from everyone else here, and I'm different too. But why they go is not too easy to remedy. You know, survey that I took last year in the Borderlands session, which incidentally is coming up right after this one after lunch in another room. But, you know, 55% of the people said they were staying because of family and so forth, but almost everybody who said why they were leaving or why they had went to the Borderlands, you know, 75% of the people said something like, well, it was the Book of Mormon or Joseph Smith story and so forth. And that's very, you know, the history is very difficult to change. We can't change the Book of Mormon or the history of the church. And so dealing with why people go is kind of complicated. But why we stay may be a little easier for us and for the church to deal with. If our church leaders and we too, thinking about our families and friends, think about good ways to stay, enhance the reasons for staying, we might have more stay. So anyway, why we stay? I was thinking, you know, this got to get on only of people like people in the Borderlands, the people of Sunstone and so forth, but you know, all during my lifetime, I've been asking people, you know, have you got a testimony and what's that based on? Are you a true believer? You try it sometime. Ask your friends, ask the people when you've got a quiet moment with them about what their real true feelings are. You'd be interested. But I kind of assumed that people who were true believers weren't asking themselves, why do I stay? But we have a cousin who's very active, students at BYU, missions, the whole business, you know. One time she was visiting us, and I said, not too long, I asked her, you know, are you a true believer? That was kind of a shocking question, but she said, yes. And I said, well, do you believe Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon or what they're claimed to be? And she said, yes, I do. And I said, well, if you didn't believe that, if you questioned it or wondered about it, would you stay? And she came right back, no, I wouldn't. I said, why? It's too hard. They ask so much of me. They take my time. And, you know, it's just constant effort on my part to meet all the demands of the church. That's how she responded to me. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about, or maybe give you another
one or two examples of this. And also, in the Borderlands session, I'll have some more additional time, too, to talk a little bit about this. But let me talk about the why we stay. I love the word why. My parents, my wife, they don't particularly like the idea that I like the word why so much. We have to be careful when we ask why, but let me talk about that a little bit. I'll talk about some of the people I've been talking to, and then I'll talk about myself, and then I'll talk a little bit about you. I was just a week or two ago riding in a car with a really great guy. I just met him, and I asked him, you know, what was your history? And, you know, he came from a place where the church works great. South America, poor country. He got interested in religion, joined the church when he was 15. They helped him. They brought him to the States. They helped him get an education. He works for the church now. And this guy is a great guy. I mean, I was thoroughly impressed with him. But I asked him, what about your testimony experience? What was your conversion experience like? And he said, paused, and he said, the testimony thing was a long time coming. And then he changed the subject, so I didn't get a chance to really pursue that. And eventually, the ride was over, and I had to leave. But you know, it's just interesting the various reasons that people stay with the church. Everybody has their own thinking about it. And I'll give you some of my reasons. Of course, my reasons have changed over. If you'd asked me this 25 years ago, I'd have a completely different set of reasons. A lot of the reasons I was staying earlier have gone away, and I've got new reasons. Basically, my main reason I stay is because you stay. And so I'll get into that a little bit. But when I was younger, you know, you'll remember this, those of you who are in this seventh decade, what a way to put it. I never thought of it that way. But if you could afford it, when I was in my 30s, if you were to afford it, before the Woody Allen movies came out and downplayed the whole thing, you know, we would go get analysis. You'd go get analyzed. And so I did that. I could afford it. And so for about 3 years I went, and after we got through the foolishness, we got down to the meat of the thing, which was to try to figure out why I do things. What were my reasons for doing things? What were my motives for doing things? And I mean, session, you know, week after week, we would go over this again. Well, why, if you do that, why do you do that? Why do you do that? Why that? What's the motive for that? And that was probably one of the most valuable experiences I ever had in my lifetime because, you know, everybody's talking about, well, the examined life is worth living and so forth. And so, of course, everybody was going to, who could afford it, was going to analysis. I learned that there's a way to examine why you do things. And you've probably heard this before, but I'll just repeat it. But I've learned that there are presenting reasons, and then there are other reasons, and then there are the hidden unconscious reasons. And it's usually those hidden unconscious reasons that really drive us to do things. The presenting reasons are those that sound grand and that sound expected, the ones that sound good. It's the answer that people want to hear. It's the acceptable one. It's the one that easy comes to mind. It's the righteous answer. It's the first thing that comes to mind. It's the surface answer. It's what we use to excuse sometimes poor behavior. But nevertheless, we all have presented reasons. For example, why do I pay tithing? Well, if we talked 25 years ago, you know, I would have given you the presenting reasons. Well, we are commanded to pay our tithing. I love the Lord. I'm going to pay tithing. It sets a good example for my kids. That's why I pay tithing. I mean, we hear this. This is, you know, a church. When you get we have a little script we go through it in our church meetings. There's a lesson, a question, and a scripted answer. And people go back and forth, and we hear the same thing every time. Rarely do we get to the other reasons or to the hidden motives. The other reasons, for example, that I could come up with for paying tithing, for example, hey, I want the blessings that come with the tithing. paying tithing. I need that temple recommend. Now, this isn't necessarily spoken out, but, you know, most people have this in their mind, behind in their mind. They can actually bring this up. I want to be a part of, an accepted part of the member of this group. If I don't have a temple recommend, or if I don't pay my tithing, you know, I'm not going to be accepted. And, you know, maybe we can also think, well, the church needs the money. They don't get the tithing, they're not going to do anything. So, you know, they need it. So those things are there. There's sort of other reasons. Then there are the hidden reasons, the motives that may be greater drivers than we recognize. For example, and it takes a lot of effort, a lot of personal honesty, and a lot of thinking, and maybe talking to your spouse and talking to others and just digging and digging and digging to find out what these other reasons are. For example, you know, 25 years ago, my reason for paying tithing would have included fear. Boy, if I don't pay my tithing, I'm going to be punished. I'm going to get sick. I'm going to lose everything I have. And then there were other things like, well, I want to have power, and I want to have authority. I want to keep my calling. I want to be in the bishopric. I want to be in the state presidency. I got to pay my tithing to do that. I want to be rich. If I pay my tithing, I'm going to be rich. Those are some of the hidden motives that I personally had for myself 25 years ago. Now I have a completely different set of motives today, but I have a hard time always making sure that the real motives are what are driving me, and I'm not just falling back on the presented motives. I recently finished a service mission. I had to pay full tithing for those 2 years, and I won't go into all the details, but you know, you do what you have to do. Anyway, which ones are important? The hidden ones are important, but they're all important. We need to recognize what they are. Once we do, then we can make intelligent choices for ourselves as to how to proceed, what we need to do. Is it really worth it? Should I really go or really stay? And once we understand all those motives, so how do you determine that? Well, hard work. So my reasons for staying. The presenting reason is that I'm helping people like you. I've got the Borderlands column. I've got the For Those Who Wonder book. I love the letters that come back to me. So this is one from, I won't give any names, but your book has literally saved me from spiritual death. Somebody wrote. Somebody else. Your lines of reasoning and ways of coming to terms with various contradictions and difficulties are keeping me and my wife in the church. So I get, you know, this drives me. These are kind of the presenting reasons that I stay with the church. Then I feel some other things, of course, that I know right away. I feel a need to be part of my LDS group. I want to be part of my ward. I want to have some group acceptance. It's in my life and in my history and in my DNA. I feel like I'm a Mormon. I mean, I'm a Mormon. How can I leave? And I feel like, you know, I'm a participating student of Mormonism. So if we'll be a participating member, I have to stay. And I want to be a follower of Jesus. And, you know, it seems like a good way to do it is as a member of the church. Now the hidden motives, and these are the ones I have to dig deep to find. And staying makes me feel like maybe I have a foot into Fowler's fourth fist of stage five faith. Now that's a kind of selfish thing. I think if you think you're in stage five or six, you're probably not. But I like the attention. You know, standing in front of you and giving a speech like this, that's heady. I don't have any place else to go. Where would I go if I left Mormonism? I want to have some control over my life and some control over this. If I stay, I feel like I have a little bit of control. I feel some anger and frustration at the system that we live in. We don't get the benefits like they do in South America, where they're doing a great work for all these poor people and lifting them up, providing health care and education and everything. Somehow we're slipped out of that a little bit. I don't remember, was it Levina said she thought she'd leave it to Jesus to want to change the church, but I feel like I want to change things. Maybe you're right, I should probably leave it to Jesus. And I know that I don't, you know, I have very little impact. But I think collectively all of us have an impact. If the church knows that we're staying and we make ourselves known, and they know what we're doing, that it'll have some impact on making things better. You know, I write letters to the general authorities, and during the Borderlands session, I'm going to share some stories, the most recent responses from some of them. I don't have time to go into it now, but interesting. And I don't know whether, you know, I don't think I've had an impact necessarily, but at least people are thinking and talking about it. So come to that session if you want to hear more about it. But is it worth it to stay and do what I do? What impacts has it had on me, my family, my friends, others? If I look at all of those things, I'd have to say yes, it is worth it for me. I look at all the motives and I say to myself, you know, I could find lots of good things outside the church, but I think I'm best in here. And so that's the reason I stay. It's still good for me. And my time is just about up here. Why do you stay? You know, what I'm suggesting you do is do like I do, or try to do. Sometimes it's aggravating for my wife, but think about the motives. Think about the reasons. Go beyond the presenting reasons and think about all of the reasons, the hidden reasons. Talk it over with your spouse. Why do you think I'm staying in the church? Well, obviously you want to be bishop. Really? Okay. Maybe I do. So anyway, I think if you do this, you'll feel much better about your position. You'll feel much reassured. I am staying for the right reasons. And there are some people, you know, of the borderlands, a lot of people just travel through the borderlands, and as they go through, if I personally don't feel, or if they don't personally want to stay, I wish them Godspeed as they go and help them through. But there are a lot of people like us who need to stay. And I think if you evaluate it like I suggested, you'll find a lot of reasons to stay. Anyway, thanks so much.
Unlike past sessions, we do have about 7 minutes. I don't know if some of you would like, anyone would like to come up and address a question to one of the participants on the panel. If not, why, we can go to lunch early. Come up, Kent.
Just quickly, let me know what your most recent callings in the church have been. I realize the question doesn't quite fit for Lavina, but...
I'm the permanent Relief Society substitute pianist.
Great.
I've been on the Washington, D.C. State High Council for...
Microphone.
I've been on the Washington, D.C. State High Council for 3 years. I'm trying to think. I'm the family history consultant for the ward, the official MC at all ward events, the gadfly of the ward, and I work on the Joseph Smith papers.
I did special projects for the state president and then the public affairs council, and I was chairman of the Bridgefielders in Harlem committee.
As I mentioned, I've recently been released from a 2-year service mission, and I still do some work with that group as a volunteer. But in my ward, I'm the emergency preparation coordinator and home teacher.
Any other questions?
Okay, well, why don't we give a round of applause to the people who've been here?